Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Pastor Doug Padgett, Executive Director of the Minneapolis-based organization Vote Common Good, who reflects on how his community and the nation have responded to the ICE killing of Renee Good. Immigration rights activists at a rally in New Haven, Connecticut, who celebrate the announcement by Avelo Airlines that they will soon be ending their deportation flights for ICE after an 8-month protest and boycott campaign. And Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines the illegality of the U.S. attack on Venezuela and a recent vote in the U.S. Senate to constrain President Trump by advancing the War Powers Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After the U.S. military attack on Venezuela and the abduction of its president, Nicolas Maduro, who's facing drug trafficking charges in the U.S., Donald Trump talked about their next target, annexing Greenland, which has been part of Denmark for 300 years. The island's population of 57,000 mostly Inuit people favor independence and vehemently oppose becoming a U.S. territory. The Trump White House recently floated a plan to give each Greenland resident a direct payment of up to $100,000 to broker a free association agreement where the U.S. would provide services like mail delivery and military protection, which is already provided by Denmark. Greenland's leaders have categorically rejected all of Trump's offers, even as talks are continuing with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen recently declared that a U.S. attack on Greenland would mean the end of the NATO Defense Pact, and therefore post-Second World War security. The Guardian reports United Healthcare, the largest health insurance company in the U.S., is refusing to provide critical internal documents to a U.S. Senate investigation into UHC's cost-cutting efforts to reduce nursing home patient transfers to hospitals. Democratic Senators Ron Wyden and Elizabeth Warren, members of the Senate Finance Committee, are looking into allegations that United Healthcare paid bonuses to nursing homes to decrease patient transfers to hospitals, even in cases like strokes where critical care is needed. United Health has denied that its employees prevent hospital transfers and said it was the responsibility of the treating physician and the facility to decide on a patient's best course of care. In an exposé last spring, The Guardian identified a number of cases where nursing homes failed to order hospital transfers for patients after intervention by United Health staffers. In one case, a patient suffered permanent brain damage following his delayed transfer. Western Pennsylvania is dealing with decades of toxic pollution from recent natural gas fracking waste and old abandoned coal mines that are creating new threats to public health. Over the course of more than a decade, the Westmoreland landfill, southeast of Pittsburgh, accepted hundreds of thousands of tons of oil and gas wastewater, toxic and often radioactive byproducts that include radionuclides like radium, uranium, and thorium, as well as harmful substances like arsenic, lead, and benzene. Inside Climate News reports that oil and gas companies operating in Pennsylvania generated nearly 8.8 million tons of solid waste between 2017 and 2024. In an average year, that's more waste than is produced by all residents and industries in Allegheny County, home to Pittsburgh, the state's second largest city. Activists complain the ever-increasing volume of waste is polluting streams, creeks, and rivers, posing a health threat to where local residents swim, recreate, fish, and source their drinking water. In 2020, then-Attorney General, now Governor Josh Shapiro, announced a grand jury investigation into fracking, which concluded that Pennsylvania had failed in its responsibility to protect the public from the environmental and health impacts of that industry. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
On the morning of January 7th, an ICE agent operating in a Minneapolis neighborhood shot and killed Renee Good, a U.S. citizen. ICE agent Jonathan Ross shot Good three times as the 37-year-old mother of three was parked in her SUV and began driving forward, turning the vehicle away from Ross, who was standing near the driver's side. Within hours, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and Vice President J.D. Vance accused Good of being a domestic terrorist and a brainwashed far-left insurrectionist who caused her own death. President Trump insisted that the agent acted in self-defense, repeating a lie that Good had run over the officer. Eyewitness accounts and several video recordings of the shooting contradicted the Trump regime's aggressive effort to demonize and criminalize Renee Good. The FBI reversed an initial agreement that an investigation into Good's death would be conducted jointly by both the FBI and Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, leading many to believe the Trump administration was actively engaging in a cover-up. Six federal prosecutors in Minnesota resigned on January 13th over the Justice Department's push to investigate Renee Good's widow. Five prosecutors from the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division also resigned in protest after the DOJ blocked a civil rights investigation into determining whether the ICE officer's use of deadly force was justified. Your reporter spoke with Pastor Doug Padgett, executive director of the Minneapolis-based organization Vote Common Good, that mobilizes people of faith to challenge the Republican Party's extremist right-wing agenda. Here he talks about how his community and the nation have responded to Renee Good's death, with over 1,000 protests across the U.S. organized on short notice, and the threat that Trump's masked ICE secret police force poses to the rule of law and democracy.
In so many ways that I'm so proud of our city for the response that we had just hours after Renee was shot dead by an ICE agent. I was down on the scene and there were already hundreds of people gathered. The area was cordoned off by the police and it was right around three blocks away from where George Floyd was murdered. So many of us gathered right in that same neighborhood 5.5 years ago when there was another, in that case, a Minneapolis police killing of a person in our city. And so here we saw a number of organizers and protesters and city activists having to gather again. There's a lot of ways I'm so proud of the way that the different communities, the faith communities, the civic communities, the on-the-ground street organized communities came together. And that's partly because we're well-versed in this. Our little city here of Minneapolis has suffered in the last 5.5 years under the murder of George Floyd, a terrible school shooting. That killed a bunch of Catholic children at their Catholic school, started at the beginning of the school year. Political assassinations of state senator and state representative for the election last November. And now this killing of Renee Good by federal agents. And the number of vigils that we've had to organize and the number of rallies and the number of calling out to our public officials, you have to do something about it. Too many of us are getting too good at this. And we shouldn't have to be this good at figuring out how to raise a moral voice in opposition to laws that provide too many opportunities for harm and for these kind of brutal activities, half of which have come at the hands of people that we've invested with so much power and trust in our communities through our law enforcement agencies.
Since the shooting on January 7th, Pastor Padgett, there's been an active campaign to smear the victim of the shooting, Renee Good, the 37-year-old mother of three. They've described her as a domestic terrorist and a brainwashed far-left insurrectionist that caused her own death. That's a paraphrase of what Vice President J.D. Vance said just a few days ago. It seems that the objective here is to demonize and criminalize Renee Good to convince Americans that it was legitimate and to normalize her death. How do you respond to what really seems to be a very ugly campaign?
A despicable way in which members of this Trump administration seem to slander and speak hateful of Americans is heartbreaking. You know, what we expect out of our leaders, J.D. Vance and Donald Trump and Secretary Noem, is for them to say, anytime an American citizen loses their life, we grieve. Anytime a law enforcement officer uses deadly force, we need to take it seriously. Anytime there's a community that's in fear, they need to be able to turn to their governments, their state government, local government, federal government for solace. Instead, we hear just the opposite. We hear J.D. Vance blaming Americans for their own homicide. We hear Kristi Noem spreading lies about what happened. We hear Donald Trump being so conflated with the information that he's received that he can't speak clearly. It is a smear campaign, not just against Renee Good. It is a smear campaign against Americans, against anyone who opposes this administration for what they do and how they do it. The one thing that we know the Trump administration wants to unleash on America, on Greenland, on Venezuela, on Mexico, is violence. The thing they know is how to use scorn and anger and words of violence and actions of violence and bullying. And to quote the president, I want to punch them in the face. And so anger and violence begets anger and violence. So when we feel our anger burning, find a way to direct it and then find someone to help. You know what people need in a moment of crisis and violence? They need beauty and care and kindness.
That was Pastor Doug Padgett, executive director of the Minneapolis-based organization Vote Common Good. Find a link to their website and related news and commentary on the ICE shooting death of Renee Good by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Avelo Airlines, a regional U.S. budget carrier serving smaller airports, announced on January 8th that it will be ending its deportation flights for Immigration and Customs Enforcement later this month, opponents of the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign had reason to celebrate. In late April last year, when immigrant rights activists in New Haven, Connecticut, learned that Avelo would be flying deportation flights out of an airport in Arizona, they launched a protest campaign and boycott of the airline that soon went national. The company acknowledged at the time that they were joining the deportation business to boost their bottom line. The Boycott Avelo campaign generated a petition signed by more than 40,000 people. Not all were potential customers, but the national scope of the campaign was a reputational hit. Boycotters claimed victory when the company announced that it will withdraw from ICE deportation flights as of January 27th, purely as a business decision. In response to the announcement, more than 100 people rallied in downtown New Haven to celebrate. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and brings us excerpts of some of the speeches. We hear first from Promika, a Yale law student.
It was because of the coordinated efforts of organizers from New Haven to Baltimore to Mesa to Salem to Massachusetts to Maine to North Carolina and beyond, who organized tirelessly for months against this airline. It was because of all of the people of New Haven, the people of conscious of New Haven, who decided not here, not in our city.
That was Fumika. Next is Kika Matos, a longtime New Haven resident and president of the National Immigration Law Center.
New Haven and Connecticut said, and we led the way. For months, community members, organizers, and local leaders kept the pressure on. We organized, we protested, we boycotted, and we said we would not stop until Avello stopped being complicit in human suffering. Over time, a local fight became a national campaign. Finally this week, Avello caved. And today, we celebrate. Let this be a reminder that when we fight,
we win.
When we fight,
we win.
When we fight,
we win.
But this victory does not mean that the struggle is over. Far from it. Because ICE is still on our streets, kidnapping our neighbors, terrorizing our families, and acting like lawless thugs with badges. They were here today in this block, snatching people away in broad daylight, and it is happening everywhere. ICE is acting with impunity, and there is no accountability. Are we gonna let this happen?
No.
Are we gonna fight back?
Yeah.
Are we gonna fight for justice?
Yeah.
No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
That was Kika Matos with the National Immigration Law Center. Next up is the Reverend Scott Marks, Executive Director of New Haven Rising, a community organization fighting for good jobs at Yale University.
Acknowledging the victory, we give thanks today for the power of our collective voices. Let us be clear, change did not happen by chance. Avella Airlines did not simply pivot their strategy. They retreated because tens of thousands of us stood together to prove that family separation is a toxic asset.
That was the Reverend Scott Marks with New Haven Rising. Next up is Tabitha Sukdio, Director of Connecticut Students for a Dream.
We are gathered here today because people spoke up, because communities refused to stay silent, because we said clearly that no airline should be in the business of deportation, and no company should profit from the suffering of our neighbors. Avello Airlines made the decision to end its contract with the Department of Homeland Security because people organized. It's also because people protested, people boycotted. There is power in our dollar, because people said that we will not accept seeing human beings flown out of our communities in chains. This moment matters to us, and I hope that it brings us more power. It is proof that people have power. But we also gather here today in grief. Yesterday, as we all know, in Minneapolis, Renee Nicole Good was shot and killed by ICE agents while trying to protect her neighbors. What happened to her is not separate from why we are here today. It is part of the same system, a system that dehumanizes, a system that treats immigrant lives as disposable, a system that uses violence and then asks us to look away. We gather in grief and in resistance because this violence is not inevitable. It is a choice, and choices can be challenged. Avello's decision shows us something important. When people refuse to normalize harm, when we withdraw our money, our support, and our silence, institutions are forced to respond. This is what accountability looks like. This is what people power looks like.
That was Tabitha Sukdio, Executive Director of Connecticut Students for a Dream, one of the speakers at a rally, celebrating Avello Airlines' decision to end its ICE deportation flights, as well as mourning the death of Renee Good, who had been killed by ICE in Minneapolis the day before. Find more news and commentary about the Avello Airlines protest campaign victory by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the aftermath of President Trump's January 3rd order directing the U.S. military to deploy 150 aircraft to bomb army bases near Venezuela's capital, Caracas, and then kidnap the nation's president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores, there's a general consensus that these actions were unlawful under both U.S. and international law. According to legal experts, the U.S. attack that Venezuela's interior minister says killed 100, including 32 members of Cuba's military and intelligence service, was illegal because Venezuela posed no imminent armed threat, the assault wasn't authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and lacked any legitimate claim of self-defense. Instead, Trump has repeatedly asserted that the attack was driven by his goal of controlling Venezuela's vast oil resources. Trump's lawless campaign targeting Venezuela began in early September, when the U.S. military bombed dozens of small open unarmed boats allegedly carrying illicit drugs in the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean. On September 2nd last year, the U.S. launched a double-tap strike on a boat that intentionally killed two shipwreck survivors of an initial attack, killing a total of 11 Venezuelans on board. Recent news reports say that attack was carried out by a military aircraft disguised as a civilian plane, a possible war crime under both international and U.S. military legal standards. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Here she examines the illegality of the U.S. attack on Venezuela and a recent vote in the U.S. Senate to advance a war powers resolution to prevent Donald Trump from taking future military action against Venezuela without congressional authorization.
If you go on to Truth Social, Trump has a big picture of himself there, and it's his official picture. And underneath, you know what it says? Acting President of Venezuela. He is illegally occupying Venezuela, and if the Vice President, Darcy Rodriguez, who is just sworn in as interim president, doesn't do exactly what he wants, he said that the consequences for her will be worse than Maduro, who was kidnapped. He and his wife, the First Lady of Venezuela, were kidnapped in this act of aggression, in invading a sovereign country, killing upwards of 80 people. Highly illegal. Now, let me say that the War Powers Resolution allows the president to introduce U.S. armed forces into hostilities or imminent hostilities only after Congress has declared war or in a national emergency created by an attack on the U.S. Senator Tim Kaine and some other senators introduced a War Powers Resolution, and it says that if it's adopted, it says Congress hereby directs the president to terminate the use of U.S. armed forces for hostilities within or against Venezuela unless explicitly authorized by a declaration of war or specific authorization for the use of military force. Well, on Thursday, the Senate advanced that resolution by a vote of 52-47, which means that it will be voted on this week by the full Senate. And five GOP senators joined 40, all the Democrats, to vote to advance this resolution. Well, those five GOP senators, Collins, Murkowski, Paul, Hawley, and Young, Trump is threatening them now, basically that their reelection is not secure. But we'll see what the Senate does. I mean, Congress has not really shown us much backbone at all in standing up to Trump, who's, you know, running over the Constitution like a steamroller.
Right.
So we'll see what happens.
And it's true that whether the House votes for this resolution or not, Trump can still veto it unless it's overridden by a two-thirds roll call vote in both the House and Senate, which
doesn't seem likely, unfortunately. No.
Trump has seemed greatly emboldened with his threats across the world since his invasion and kidnapping of Maduro in Venezuela. He's threatened Cuba, Colombia, Mexico, Panama, Canada, Greenland, and Iran. It seems like we have a megalomaniac in office who, by his own words, says, I don't need international law.
He says the only thing that could limit his power is his own quote-unquote morality. Well, we are in a bad situation if that's what's guiding U.S. policy right now, and it seems it is. What happens to the rules-based international order? International law has always been selectively enforced by the United States. They use the a la carte approach to international law. But Marjorie, I would ask you, is Trump delivering a death knell to international law?
There is this democratic body in the UN, and it's called the General Assembly, and there are 193 countries, and each country has a vote, and they can convene under what's called the Uniting for Peace Resolution, where if the Security Council is unable or unwilling to fulfill its duties under the UN Charter, the General Assembly can step in. And that's what we should be, pressuring countries to do, is to convene under Uniting for Peace. Now, I'm not saying that it's a panacea or it would end things, but it would help things. But there's another concept, too, and it sounds kind of flaky, but it's something that's real and really does have some impact, and it's called the mobilization of shame. And that is that the United States, by really attacking and obstructing the international law, is shamed in the eyes of the world. You know, it's true that our allies will walk in lockstep, but there are a lot of countries in the world that are just appalled at what the United States is doing. Will that stop Trump? I don't know. All bets are off. The Democrats should take back at least one House of Congress during the midterms this year, but, you know, the Trump administration is doing everything it can to change the rules and cheat. So I don't even know if that would be a check on this out-of-control autocratic power.
That was Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Find a link to her recent commentary titled, "Trump Will Try to Defend Aggression Toward Venezuela, It's Still Illegal," by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KTAL in Las Cruces, New Mexico, KMUD in Garberville, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Nikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.